Yeah. By the way, my name is Zahid Said. I am Communications TSP at Mid-Atlantic Region. If you're not familiar with Mid-Atlantic Region, this is Washington, D.C. So Virginia, Washington, D.C., and Richmond area I cover. I am with Microsoft since 2011. Before that, I was working more with the partners like IBM. I had like about 8 to 10 years experience in Cisco. So if anybody, you know, familiar with the Cisco environment, I will be happy to, you know, discuss the correlation between the Cisco and Link, and sometime during the call routing, if something comes, I can explain that. And I have my peer, Tim.
Hi.
You want to introduce? Yeah.
Yep. My name is Tim Rang. I am Zahid's colleague in Mid-Atlantic. I'm TSP as well. I've been in the role about 4 months. I spent the previous 10 years in the Link product group. So between he and I, you know, any questions you have, we should be able to cover those. Thank you all for staying for the last session of the week. And anybody that needs to get up and leave, don't feel bad. Zahid himself is going to have to jet out of here about halfway through. So I would ask, if you have very pointed questions, go ahead and ask them. But in general, try to save them for the end. We're going to get him out of here, and I'll take care of you at the end of the session.
Right. So I will have like flight 130. So, but hopefully I will cover, and I should be able to take questions during that time, yeah. So today we would like to cover about the WISE deployment and the call routing piece. That's the most will be a focus. We will do a deep dive into that, how we can configure the call routing and the normalization and infrastructure point of view. And also, Tim will talk about the call handling services like response groups and the maybe group call pickup, and we'll touch base about the devices. What we are not covering in this session, because it's like I have maybe 30, 35 minutes, so we are not focusing on location-based routing. That is not part of that. I think Doug is covering that. We are also not covering interop with PBX, like Cisco or Avaya if you have Link, and how the call routing works on that. I think Jamie is covering that. But if there are any specific questions, if you have, I will be happy to answer that. But we are not covering as part of this session. So I put one slide on the sponsors here because what we believe, based on our experience, that the having an executive sponsor, especially in the Link deployment, is really critical. Because there is already existing PBX. Most of the time you have Cisco, Avaya, or Nortel, or anything, you know, and then the networking team is normally saying, okay, we have concerns, we are not sure what the Link can do there, how it's going to be integration, how you can do QoS on that, how the call admission control going to work, so and how the security going to happen, right? So there are so many questions comes, especially when we do the Link deployment. So we always recommend to have executive sponsor there who is the champion for the Link and make sure that we can set the objectives, you know, what we want to achieve if this is a pilot, what's the scope is that, how many users we are talking about that, what are the timelines, what we want to achieve at the end of this, right? So get involved to your sponsor with the networking team and get their buying. Because ultimately, what we see, we are very good contacting with the desktop team, you know, and because we are doing Exchange, SharePoint, we have very good sync with that. But what I have seen, based on my experience, the telecom team or the networking team, they have the budget for the PBX piece and the telecom. So it's really good to get their buying there. I think maybe you guys have seen the same experience in the field, but that's what I observe most of the time. So going to the call routing part here, so there are the couple of components. One is about the user habits, right? How we educate the Link if the user is dialing a number, how to treat that number. If the people are used to link-to-link calling, they know, like, right-click on the name and it's just going to call, going to go, right? That's fine. It's no-brainer. But people like me who came from PBX or telephony world, I always think when I joined in 2011, I think I was saying, okay, I should dial 9 to go out or I should dial 8 to go out, right? And if I am in North Carolina, I should dial 7-digit. If I am in Toronto, I should dial 10-digit with 9, right? And if I am, like, in Europe somewhere, the variable length, what should I dial? So it's it's really how we educate the link, how to make it normalized to become an E164 number, which is kind of different for the PBX. And I will talk more about the E164 number when I go to the next slide. So it's all about educating the link, how much we can feed. So if somebody even dial a four-digit extension, it needs to be converted to E164 number. And why? There are many reasons. We will discuss why it's very important to have that E164 number there. So if we talk about the user habits, right? So if you, as I said, if you call by name, the call will go no issue at all and it will happen. But if it's dialing an emergency number, let's say 911, I think in Europe it's 999 or it's whatever is there. So it will go, we will say, okay, when the call comes, just take that on a separate route and go for the emergency call. However, when a number is like 7-digit, 10-digit, 11-digit, dialing international with 011, or if you're in Europe, 001, how to treat that, right? So that's the time we feed into the link, okay, get it normalized. Convert into E164 number to go it out, and then the second part starts here. When the call is out from the link, right? So there are two ways when the call is out of the link. One is like the user, the other user is not in the link. It could be another user in another PBX, like via Cisco, or the call is going to a like any cell number. Let's say I call from here to Toronto. So the call will leave from the link, and then it will go to a PSTN network. Then there we have other things to take care of, like infrastructure, right? How the user will be treated. Do I have permissions to call or no? If I am dialing an international number, can I dial the number or no, right? And which gateway should I take out? And what are my permissions? So this is the second part, the gateway selection, which we will discuss in detail. And the third part is how the call goes out and how it gets terminated. We talk about the E164 number. There are so many reasons, you know, we can talk why it's important. One of the best which I feel coming from a traditional PBX background is when you are in the office, you know, doing the typing the notes or something, you see a number, if it's E164 number, you just right click on that, it let it go out, right? So you don't need to think about how I gonna dial 9 or gonna dial 8, so it's full number. The second is when you're gonna see in the next section about the infrastructure, when we are selecting the routes, and then we have to associate the gateways with that route. It's much easier when you do it by E164 number. When you have, say, +31, +61 for Australia, or +1 for US, it's much easier to associate that. And also within the Active Directory, right? It's much, if we have that E164 number, we don't need to worry about the, you know, doing the translation and all of that. Also about the federation, right? If you want to call somebody, if it's federated with your organization, anywhere in the world, if you right-click on that, if it's E164 number, it can call to the user and it can call to his cell number too. That is also possible. So this is not like must-have thing. If we're talking like strictly speaking, you should not. It's not like it cannot work. It will still work. But we need to create maybe some other translation rules to make that happen. So we recommend to have that converted to E164 number. Any questions here so far? Are we good with the E164, like the two things, user habits and infrastructure? Okay, then there are the dial plans, right? So what are the dial plans? We talk about the normalization rule. This is the same thing if we want to convert, let's say, 4-digit or 8-digit, how we can get it normalized, how we can create the pattern that can become an E164 number. So one thing to remember about the dial plan, which is critical if you're designing a call routing. So it can be assigned per user, per pool, site, or global. It can be assigned on that. So what happens if there are like three types of dial plan, right? It could be maybe you have global, maybe you have within a pool. So the precedence is going to be always user. Let's say you have two dial plans, user and site. So the user dial plan going to take preference on that, right? So you can, let's say, You can have a dial plan for the site, but for certain users, you know, you want to give a precedence, you can put that there, and it will take effect only on those users which you want. Giving an example here how the dial plan works and how it is. So if we look at the pattern to match, By the way, how many of you are familiar with this syntax? Or it's the first time you are saying that? Okay, good. So the first example, you know, UK London four digit, if you look at that, the caret sign, it means starts with. It starts with 2, 3, followed by D, and then you have another two numbers that can come, and there is a dollar sign. It means it's going to end here. And the translation pattern, we say +44207930 and $1, it means match. Take this pattern and put it at the end of that string where we're expecting. So the full number going to be, when it is implemented, so it should be +44207930 23 and XX, any number the user dials. So it will, that's how the pattern works. And when I was, because I was used to more doing Cisco, so it was a little bit different for me, but once you get used to that, it gets simple, and also you have a kind of inventory, right? Once you do one deployment, the second time you're going to reuse that just to change a little bit, because they are most of the time same. Unless you're doing a lot of global deployments, then it gets different. And here was the second portion which we discussed about the call routing, the PSTN usage. I will try to discuss or explain the other components of the call routing, which is PSTN usages, which we're going to have the routes, and we're also going to have voice policies, how it affects and how they differ from that. So the voice policies, these are class of service or class of restriction, right? If I am a user, right, and in the PBX world or in Link world, we need to assign permission to the user where I can call, right? I can call to international, national, or wherever, a premium number. So based on that, we assign, that's called the voice policies. And then you have PSTN usages, right? So I consider PSTN usages just like a keys, right? And you have a lock, like voice policy, you insert the keys there. And whatever key you have there, you can call it. Like, let's say I have voice policy assigned to me national, then I have PSTN usage call, national, local, so I can call there. I don't have the key like international, so I will not be able to call that. It will get more clear when we will go to the next slide, then I will get a couple of scenarios, so I will try to make it more clear. And then we have routes, right? So routes, it when we say, okay, this user can call here, this has this permission, and these are the gateways associated with that. So he can use that gateway and go out, right? And on the gateway level, there are also things, you know, we want to make sure which gateway it goes, which is primary gateway, which is secondary gateway, which all can be done. And we can decide maybe 911, I always want to use this gateway. If it is going to from here maybe to Denmark, I want to use the that only Denmark gateway, so it could be least cost routing and all of that. So routes can be assigned to multiple PSTN usages, right? So this can be done. You can have one route that can assign to many PSTN and then vice versa. The same with voice policy. If you look at that on the right-hand side, I put just voice policy, and it can be assigned to multiple PSTN usages. So voice policy. So we have discussed, okay, there is class of service, class of restriction that we can get on the voice policy. In Link, there is another thing which we can do. That is it gives you flexibility to control, you know, what the other features user can get, like call forwarding, call delegation, you know, simultaneous ring, team call. So all of these capabilities, as part of that, you can assign that. Same as we discussed, I think, in the dial pattern, how the precedence is going to be. The same with voice policy. It can be done per user, per site, are global, right? So if we have a voice policy within maybe a pool or a site, maybe more than one, so again, the user gonna take preference. Maybe you can have one site policy, but there are some executives that wanna call to premium number, that wanna call to the international, so you can give them that policy that will take over, the rest will be the same. The simultaneous and call forwarding. If you guys are using, maybe have used before Link Server 2010, right? So there was not the flexibility which we have simultaneous ring. We have simultaneous ring, but we were not able to separate. If somebody has international, kind of PSTN usage or class of service, so he was able to get the simultaneous ring for that call forwarding, but he was not able to do that. you know, when he's national or something. So in 2013, we introduced a concept of customized PSTN usage. That's really a neat concept, and it's widely used now with many of the engineers in the field. What it does is, if you look at that, so here, route using the call PST, that's fine. We have at the top simultaneous ring. So you can have internal link users, and then you can have custom PSTN usage. What it does is you can say, still, you know, we can have the persons who can call international, but for simultaneous ring, he can only do national, or he can do only link, because it doesn't make any sense. Like for me, if I am outside of the country and I am getting simultaneous ring in my office and here, even I don't want to attend the call, right? So it's up to you. You can do it or you cannot do it. But that was a good feature requested by, you know, a lot of from the came feedback came from the field, and we introduced that. The PSTN usages. So the same thing. It's I consider PSTN use as a glue between the voice policy and the routes, right? So if you have a voice policy and it has no PSTN usage, right, it doesn't make any sense. And if the PSTN usages are not associated with the routes, then even if you want to make a call, it will go nowhere because it doesn't have associated gateways on that. So it's kind of glue between the two. They work together. So once we are creating the dial plan, you know, our call routings, we want to make sure how the voice policy work, what the PSTN usage has a role there, and what are the routes, how we can associate those routes there. So that's, you know, it's like a math, the call routing. I think either you know it or you don't know it, right? So there is no other way. It's going to work or it's not going to work. So once you get that art, how to configure the call routing, this is going to get very simple for you. And that's what I used to do. I always go to whiteboard, draw all the scenarios, and then I put those, and then it gets simple once you're getting used to that. And call routing is the one thing it's going to work always, right? It's not like a feature. It's coming and coming. It's there. And the other thing I want to mention is the PSTN uses the naming convention. It's really important, like when you're deploying global environment. So it's good to know, okay, it's the national usage, call it national, even sometimes call it like Seattle national, New York local or Seattle national, and then you're in Germany, say, you know, this is Germany, PSTN usage, and then based on that. Because it's going to give you a lot of flexibility down the road when you're designing your call routing. Then it tells you, okay, what was the purpose of that, and then you don't need to reinvent the wheel all the time, unless it's your last day at the work, right? You don't want to care, okay, I'm going to leave, I don't care, I'm going to put it PSTN usage 1, 2, 3, I'm not going to come to work tomorrow. So that's fine then. So the routes is where we associate the gateways there, right? So you have voice policy, then your PSTN usage, then you have your routes there. You can associate your gateways there. If we look at that, we talked about the E164 number. On the right-hand side, if you look at +31, it's much easier. If we have dial plan in E164, it's much easier to correlate that dial plan with the gateway. So +31 exceptions, then you have maybe +49 for Germany, +1 for North America. So it can be done much easier if you have E164 number. And we will discuss how we want to make sure that the gateway which we associate with the routes, which gets the priority and which one. This is, as you know, associating a gateway with the route, and it's a little bit tricky. But once you get used to that, it will get very simple, because it doesn't work the same way the Cisco or Avaya work with the selection of the routes there. So we have like the multiple trunks in the same route. How we can control now the gateway preference? That's what we discuss. Okay, we want to make sure which gateway goes where and what it happens. So if you have within one route, first of all, you can have multiple gateways, right? So you can do that, no issue at all. And if you just put there two gateways or three gateways within one route, it's going to just pick the randomly. Don't think that, you know, I'm going to say always take this gate. It's not going to happen, because we have put the routes randomly there, it can take any of that. We need to some mechanism that we force there, okay, always take this gateway. If you are going to Seattle or if you are going to maybe Toronto or some, we will see how we can do that. And you can have also multiple routes in the same usage. So if you have, I have a slide next that it will show that. And if we want to say that we want to prioritize gateway A on the gateway B, then we need to create a PSTN usage. And the PSTN usage priority matters a lot. Whatever is at the top, whatever is at the bottom, that makes a lot of difference. That makes the selection possible, which gateway you want to select. That's the way we're going to prioritize the gateways. Let's see some examples on that. So looking at this, let's say somebody dials a number 206-555-1212, right? So on the right-hand side, you can see there are some matches it can get. So we have WISE policy, Seattle WISE, but then you have PSTN usage there. As I said, naming convention is important, internal usage, local uses, Seattle. If I am doing like a global environment, I will try to make sure I am focused on each country or on each region on that. So if somebody dials the number, let's look at the possibilities. So these are the possible matches going to happen based on the dial number and the usage where they have. Can anyone tell, like, why it selected number 5 here? Why it took, like, 206-555? What was the main reason? Yeah, it's maybe the closest match, yeah. Absolutely. Any other suggestion here? Why it took number 5, why it didn't took number 6, why it didn't took 7? Sorry? It was placed at the top, so yeah. So coming from Cisco background, I'm going to say, okay, it's going to, because it's the closest match, it's going to pick it. But what link does it, it's going to take what comes first. So even if the number 7 was number 5, it's going to take number 7. It's going to take number 7, right? So whatever comes first is going to pick that. Then we will see how we can do that. So if we want to prioritize a certain gateway, we need to put in a separate PSTN usage, and that PSTN usage needs to be put at the top and associate that gateway with that, with the dial pattern. Then it can happen. Otherwise, it's going to pick randomly there. Another example, 312-666-1212. Let's eliminate the possibilities here. So based on the the device policy and usage, it's going to select the 312 or plus 1 plus, and these are the maximum possibilities it has. Because why it selected again number 2? Because it was at the top 2, and then it has the closest match. By the way, if gateway 1 is down, right, it automatically going to select to the gateway 2 because we already gave that option. Gateway 1 and gateway 2 is there. If it gets, sorry, yeah.
Is it one after the other or
is it random? So here, the gateway 1 we put there, it can pick that one. It will take that. If it gets down, then it will go to the gateway 2. But yeah, it's the failover, yeah. Yeah, it can take that, and again, if we want to make sure that that happens, the other gateway, then we need to put into PSTN usage if required. Let's say if gateway 1 and gateway 2 both are down, right? So then automatically it's going to pick to the gateway 3 there. So it can do that, right? And if gateway 1 and gateway 2, as I said, it's going to randomly pick, it's maybe, it can also take sometime gateway 2 because we are not giving any preference there, right? So it can decide any of that. So it doesn't work under special kind of algorithm. If you want to make sure, it always selects gateway 1. So we need to make sure we put gateway 1 associated with the pattern and put the PSTN usage at the top. So this can be done. Now we're going to talk about the trunk a little bit. Any questions, by the way, so far here? Either everything is good or everything is wrong. Okay. So in Link Server 2013, we have the capability in Link Control Panel that we can have, multiple trunks there. So it's kind of logical association between a mediation server and the listening port and a PSTN gateway and the listening port, right? So we can have no flexibility, have more, we can have scalability to configure the translation pattern at the trunk level. Before it was done on the gateway, still it can be done on the gateway, but now you can have multiple trunks and you can associate them with the gateway. So once you change it on the trunk level, then you can do it. You don't need to do on like 15 or 20 gateways separately on that. That is all possible, right? And if you look at the right-hand side, you see some options when we are configuring the trunks there. So because the trunks needs to be associated with the gateways, we want to make sure which gateway we are talking about. It's really important. If we are talking about Cisco gateway, I always give the example Cisco first. I don't know if Mike's going to like it or no, but yeah. So this is the Cisco gateway. They are not enhanced gateways, right? Because they don't. They are doing. If we are talking about the SRTP, they are doing SRTP. We are doing TLS, right? So the cipher mismatch. So we cannot do encryption with them, right? And also, if you look at the other, if it's the refer, I don't know if you do. It's very critical, especially for the refer. Refer, by the way, we use, it's a SIP message that we use for the call transfer a lot, right? So if the gateway supports that message, then we should check it. Otherwise, you're going to put call on hold, and then if you want to transfer it, it's not going to happen because gateway doesn't understand, you know, what the refer is. So before doing encryption, enable media bypass, and all of that, getting the feature, we want to make sure the gateway is enhanced UOIP gateway, right? So this is, if you go to the Microsoft website on the TechNet, we have a list of gateways which are enhanced, which are basic, the PBX, what it can be done. So it's all there. You can look at that before checking this feature here. So we talked about the trunk, right? And this feature, which we're going to discuss now on the trunk, that how we can manage multiple gateways. It's also very critical, especially the people who are doing a lot of deployments, who are doing a lot of call routing, right? And that's their day-to-day job. It gives them much more flexibility to manage all those gateways on the trunk level rather than going to individual gateways, all of that, and then do some translation pattern on it. It all can be done on the trunk. So giving an example here, you see the Alice, it's calling a UK number, right? So based on the translation pattern, it's formatted to this, and it goes the call out, right? So what happens sometime, the gateway which we selected, it's going to go there. For some reason, either it's applied, the call admission control is applied, or whatever, the WAN is down, so that the call doesn't go through that gateway. And that was programmed plus 44. Then we, on the trunk level, we can create a translation pattern. We can say, you know, it's 011 type. We have another on the gateway level translation pattern create, and no, the user not going to dial the number again, right? Because he already pressed the call goes, and no, the gateway is down. So at the trunk level, the translation pattern which we have, if you look at that here, so it does, it removes the plus 44, right? And it says, you know, 011 and make it as an international call. And it can go through the other gateway using that and make that happen on the trunk level. That's critical when you are, again, doing a global environment using different gateways, and it all can be managed on the trunk side. So any questions so far, by the way, here? We are good? So I think that's what I have on the call routing then, yeah. So Tim, if you like, you can, yeah, here you go. So by the way, I will be in 5 minutes, I will be leaving because I have my flight like 1:30. And run. If there are any questions on my cell number, just call me, I will take it all while I'm riding the taxi.
Thank you, Zahid. So I'm going to shift gears here a little bit and talk about link call handling services. And so what are the call handling services? These are some of the media applications that run resident in Link Server when you configure for enterprise voice. All these applications, the four that we're going to talk about here, they do run as services on the Link front end and are generally deployed when you go through Topology Builder and set up for enterprise voice. There's not special setups that you need to do to get these applications deployed. What you're going to want to focus on is just configuration of these services as you need them. And we're going to focus on four of them here. The first one being a response group service. So the response group service is basic call distribution service inside of Link. And it provides capabilities for sort of small scale queuing environments, things like a help desk, maybe reception, applications like that. And it's a server-side media application. It's running on all your front-end servers. So any place that you have front-end servers deployed, you can host response group services there. And it is intended specifically for those simple call distribution applications. Please don't think of this as a call center, right? It is not a call center. It doesn't scale to the needs of call center applications. It doesn't provide a lot of the richness that you need out of call center applications, right? It doesn't give you reporting. It doesn't give you the ability to sort of listen in on conversations or whisper into conversations of agents from supervisors, features like that you may come to expect from larger scale call center applications. It also doesn't give you the programmability, the opportunity to dip into a database. For instance, I want to look up a status of my order, right? I need to input my order number, go off to a SQL database and report back on where my order is sitting. That programmability is not there. So, when you're looking at this application, we're going to go through how it sets up and how some of the ways that you can use it. If your needs are greater than what we're talking about here, there's plenty of folks down on the expo floor with call center solutions, and I'm sure they'd be very, very happy to spend some time with you, with the limited amount of time we have left this week, I guess. So how do we set up response groups? There's really three primary components to it, three primary steps. The first is just the configuration of the group itself, right? Who are the participants in that response group? Who are the agents? And you can configure those either by setting them up individually, selecting lists of agents that should be managing calls in that group, or you can actually go and select the distribution list so that your membership of that group can be managed at a distribution list level instead of coming in and manually managing on a user-by-user basis. And in that group, I'm looking at the wrong thing. In that group, you can have formal or informal participation policies. And what we mean by that is informal means essentially for anybody that's configured to be part of a response group that is active, you come in to work in the morning, you sign into your Link client, and you're automatically put into the group that you've been configured to. Calls can start arriving at you without taking any additional action besides just signing into your Link client and being active. Whereas formal participation requires that a user go to the response group sort of web portal and register, say, I'm ready to start accepting calls for the various queues that they may be assigned to. So that's a more formalized process so that, users sort of it's time to go on break, right? And I need to unregister. In the informal setting, you would just set yourself as busy and you can achieve some of that as well. But a lot of customers want that formality of opting into the specific work groups that they're assigned to. Your routing methods are configurable. There's a number of options here. All of these except for, I believe it's, I'm forgetting which case it is. All of these respect your present setting, meaning that if you're busy in a call, obviously you're going to be bypassed for ring out from the queue. But the options here for how to select who the calls goes to includes longest idle, parallel, where you're going to everybody at once and the first person to take the call gets it, round robin, self-explanatory. Serial might be an interesting case where maybe you have a pool of admins, right? And you have them set up as a response group as a way for them to sort of manage calls and support each other. Where somebody calls this number or calls this identity, that the primary person that is working that queue should always answer the call. They're in the restroom. They went down to the cafeteria to get something to eat. The call comes in. That person's not available, and it goes to the backup people in the queue. So the application for serial is where you want one person primarily answering all those calls. And then the alert time is basically the timer that we set, how long we wait trying to contact that person before we move to the next one in the list based on whatever your routing method is. So we've established the group. Now we want to configure the queue that the group is working off of. This is the queue where the calls go into. All right, so the first thing, obviously, is we assign the group, one or more groups to it. You can manage multiple groups, or you can have a dedicated group per queue. And the queue timeout, what this does is determines how long the caller can sit in the queue. Right, so obviously, unless you're the airline I flew out on here earlier this week, you want to leave them in there a finite amount of time before you choose to maybe send them somewhere else to get help, right? And so what this queue determines is how long I'm going to sit there before maybe I take some follow-up action, put them in another queue, maybe send them to an operator. It's actually an option for disconnecting, which it's there if you want it. I'm not really sure why you would want to do that, but it's certainly available. And queue overflow is once we've reached the maximum size of the queue, what do we do with those subsequent calls that come in? What treatment do we want for them? Again, in the case of my airline, they chose to just let that thing fill up perpetually, and you'll sit there and wait as long as you need to. In your application, maybe you've got a, for instance, say a North America help desk. If that thing queues up with more than 10 people in it, they're going to start overflowing to a help desk that is primarily tasked with supporting another region, is one of the ways that you would use that. And lastly, now we can define our workflows. What is the experience that the caller gets when they initially dial in to that response group? The most basic way of setting this up is with a hunt group. You've got a recorded greeting. You have some very basic time of day, day of the week, holiday rules for determining, is the office open? Are we available to take calls? And where do we send them? Very simple. The more complicated case is the interactive response group. And this is one that gives you two tiers of sort of, air quote, programmability around the IVR, having custom messages, prompting for input, either DTMF or voice, so that the user can sort of navigate their way through the IVR and find where they need to be, and then at each of the terminating points in those options, there is a queue that we can deliver that caller to. That is the scope of programmability for response groups, right? So if your application can be met with these requirements, it's a terrific tool for you. But if you need more programmability, you need to get in and do something more sophisticated than that again, you're probably looking for a call center. In terms of administration, in 2013, we introduced the notion of a response group manager. And all that really does is take some of the responsibility that the response group administrator has and be able to delegate small pieces of that for individual queues or workflows out to a specific manager. So, I may be the help desk manager for North America. There's a single response group administrator that sets up all these response group queues that we have deployed worldwide. But for my individual workflow, I can manage the membership of it and move people in and out and manage our preferences for what the queue setting should be, without necessarily granting them administrative access over things that are elsewhere. And that's something that was introduced in 2013. So. Just to illustrate now, let's stick with the simple case here on the left, right? We've provisioned our agent group, our queue, and our workflow in sort of bottom-up order. Calls come into the workflow based on whatever options they select. They navigate through the IVR. They get delivered into a queue. The callers wait in that queue until an agent is available to take the call, and the call gets delivered to those people, right? And the difference between on the left here where we have a manager or the unmanaged case here on the right, the only thing it's important to keep in mind to illustrate here is that when you've got managed response groups, where you have that manager role, because of the implications that modifying those queues and those agent groups can have on other groups, we need to make sure, and we manage by policy, that you cannot have queues that are configured to serve multiple workflows, or you can't have agent groups that are managing the same configured agent groups that are managing multiple queues, because otherwise your help desk manager in North America deciding to change one of the policies on his queue, if that is being reused somewhere else, is going to have impact on some other part of the business that they didn't anticipate. So if you're setting this up in an unmanaged environment, all these things can sort of sit under each other, and you can have a pretty complex, set of forking lines in here that these things all sort of work and harmonize together. But if you're doing these with response group managers, it's more of a one-to-one relationship that you're going to have to maintain. And then in terms of the identity of the agents, right, you have the choice to either make those agents anonymous or identified. And the way they're going to be identified is, think about in your link conversation window, you call the help desk. If you have agent anonymity, that caller is always going to see that they're just talking to help desk, right? But if you've got it set the other way, ultimately when you're delivered to that person, you can see the identity of the person that you're actually been connected to. For internal applications, a lot of customers think that that's a good thing, right? To be able to see who it is that you're actually talking to. It's not just some anonymous person behind the help desk. But obviously, there's obvious cases why you would want to maintain that anonymity, right? You don't want people just reaching out directly to the person that helped them. You need them to follow the workflow. You need to go through the queue so that we can manage workloads and track calls that are coming into the center. So, and the way that works is effectively your calls to the response group, they get delivered to the response group service. Agent Bob, he's the most available. The routing rules determine that the call was to be delivered to him. If the settings for the response group are for anonymity, the call continues to pass through the response group. The caller Alice sees that she's talking to a help desk agent. The media is being passed through the response group service to Bob, and he maintains his anonymity. On the flip side, if we're happy that the end recipient is to be able to be identified, when the signaling connects Bob to Alice, ultimately we establish a call directly between these two. And the one distinct advantage that we have in taking this route is if you have very busy queues, we can avoid all the media riding through the response group service, and you gain some scalability because we're not doing any media pass-through that we're able to actually establish peer-to-peer, basically a typical link call after we pass the signaling around to get them connected. The next service is unassigned number. And the purpose of the unassigned number service is that, as an enterprise, you've got, say maybe 10 or 50,000 numbers that you own, and a certain percentage of those are assigned to users, and some of them may be idle, right? And somebody either by fat finger or they got bad coordinates from somebody tries to dial into your enterprise. It's not a number that somebody occupies. You want that to be a reasonable experience, right? You don't just want a fast busy or an error tone to be generated back to the caller. So the unassigned number service offers you a little bit of configurability around what is the experience for that caller when they hit a number that a user isn't assigned to. We can play a recorded message, and after that recorded message, there's a number of redirect actions that you can take to, again, you can either disconnect after playing a message, we're sorry, there's nobody at this line, or you can actually transfer them out to, maybe to an attendant service or some queue somewhere where they can be helped by an operator or something else, depending upon your needs. The announcements for the numbering service, you can set those up in one of two ways. You can just do basic text to speech, and in the example here, we just provided basic text message in the PowerShell command to set it up. What you could also do is record a WAV file, put it on the link file store, and point to that from this configuration command as well. That's certainly your option. And then the target URI where you want them to go. And if you leave that blank, we'll play the recorded message and the call will end. And obviously you need to define your number ranges, right? So you own this range of numbers, and if you're lucky, it's a ubiquitous continuous range, but that's not typically the case, right? So we support you defining multiple ranges, and you know, somebody asked me yesterday or the day before how that scales, how many of those you can have. You know, it's at least hundreds. I don't know what the ultimate number is, but we certainly recognize that there's some need in a lot of enterprises to define and maintain multiple ranges, because you don't get a nice ubiquitous range of numbers. Probably the most important thing on this feature, if you set it up, if you remember nothing else, is make sure you're only defining ranges that are owned by Link. If these are numbers that are owned by your legacy PBX that's deployed elsewhere in the business, all your Link users start trying to dial those PBX numbers. You saw the routing rule table that Zahid had up here earlier. You might not have noticed, but you know, there's a fork pretty close to the beginning for the unassigned number range. All your calls over to the PBX users are going to get delivered to a recorded message. So you'll figure that out pretty quickly if you've made that mistake, but that's a good one to avoid. Next is call park. And I think we probably all know what call park is, but it's basically the ability to place a call on hold, be given an orbit number that can be dialed from another phone elsewhere to retrieve that call, right? It's sort of a yet another means of transfer. And in Link, calls can be parked by most Link clients. I say most because you know, your smartphone client doesn't have a call park option on it today, but your desktop clients, Link Phone Edition, a number of our compatible IP phones like SNOM, they have the ability as well to place a call on park. And once that call is placed on park, you get a notification back with that orbit number. And once you have that orbit number, any device or any client that is inside your enterprise deployment can then retrieve that, because this is basically just a routable number, right? Link essentially treats this as a phone number, right? So I could go to a PBX phone, it could be an old Nortel handset, and dial #629. And if you've got your enterprise set up, your routing rules set up properly between your PBX and Link, that call will be delivered back to Link and you'll retrieve that from the call park service. So there are some constraints in terms of which clients can park the call, but there are no constraints on where you can pick it up, short of, you know, doing it from your home PSTN phone, obviously. If calls aren't retrieved in a reasonable amount of time, there's a ringback policy that you can set that the call gets delivered back to the original person that parked the call. And if that person then doesn't pick up the call within a certain number of configured attempts, there's an opportunity to define a transfer or a fallback destination that, you know, if you don't want this person to just get randomly disconnected and then have to call back in and figure out, you know, where do I need to go again, you can have them delivered to a predefined place. And how do we set this up? One, as I mentioned earlier, this is installed by default. It's not turned on by default, but it is installed by default when you set up for enterprise voice. Zahid had some of the voice policies up there and had all the default checkboxes on there. Call park is not one of them. Not sure why, but it is not on by default. So if you do want to take advantage of that feature, you do need to turn it on. And then you need to configure your orbit ranges. And generally, we recommend that it's some sort of obvious prefix, right? I think most customers probably prefix with pound or star and then have a 3 or 4 digit number so as not to be confused with what might be an internal extension range. But you can make them whatever you want them to be, really. You configure them per pool. And the range is globally unique, which is why you're able to do the retrieval from a PBX phone. And I don't know why, but the digits need to be of uniform length, right? So be sure not to try to set this up where, say, your range is like #500 to #1500. It's a limitation. Honestly, I don't know why, but it is. It's something to keep in mind. So we talked about the policies. when a person gets placed on hold, you can configure music on hold so that they have some comfort noise, something to listen to while they're waiting. I describe what the ringback attempts are. By default, there's two. You can configure it all the way up to 10 or down to 1. The ringback timeout is by default set to a minute 30. And the fallback destination by default is to disconnect. So if it's null, your action is to disconnect after we've attempted all of the, after we've iterated through all of our ringback. So if you do want to actually deliver those calls to some destination, you need to obviously explicitly set that. And we don't really, you know, I'm not, don't want to do some ladder diagrams here, but just to help you understand exactly what the flow and the conversation flow is between the parties in this call. You know, initially we have Alice talking to Bob. In this case, I've got Alice coming through a mediation server. Maybe she's calling from the PSTN. And she's in the call with Bob. The media is passing directly between the mediation server and Bob's endpoint. At some point, Bob chooses to park the call. You know, it's usually because you want to hand off the call to some other person, but you don't know exactly how to reach them, so you want to make a broadcast to them, like maybe over paging, or, you know, one of the ways I use it sometimes is that I sit in an open work environment. Call starts to drag on. I'm concerned that I'm irritating my neighbors. I'm going to run over to a conference room. I'll park it, note the orbit number, run in there, dial that back out, right? And that's another application for it as well. So Bob parks the call. Link server gives him a notification back telling him, okay, that was successful. Your orbit number is pound 199. Bob needs to convey that somehow. Maybe he puts it in an IM, maybe he yells across the hall, whatever, right? And ultimately, Charlie chooses to pick up that call. He dials pound 199, establishes connectivity back to the mediation server. Alice, depending upon if she's got a rich enough endpoint, can see that she's now talking to a different person. In this case, it's Charlie. Bob gets a notification that his call was picked up elsewhere, so he doesn't have to be concerned, you know, did anybody retrieve this? And the fourth of the features is group call pickup. And the scenario is different, but architecturally this is very, very similar to call park. So group call pickup is the ability for, you know, perhaps a team of workers to retrieve incoming calls by dialing a number, right? So if Zahid were still here, I'd use him in my example. We're on a sales team together. Somebody calls Zahid's number. I see he's not there. It's ringing 4-5 times. I'm concerned that call might not go through, and we never want to let a call go to voicemail in our group. So what I do, I know that he has a predefined extension that I can dial, that when I dial that extension, it grabs that call from him, and I can field it for him. And the way that works is we essentially fork the call to the call park service. So the call is ringing for Bob, or Zahid in my example here. The call is ringing for him, but it's also sitting on the call park service at some pre-configured extension that I know about that I can punch in and grab the call from. The way we administer that is to ride on the back of the call park orbits and use an administrative tool that maybe some of you are familiar with. I forget what the acronym stands for, the CIFA util. The important thing to remember, aside from the syntax, if you ever need to set this up, this is not a user policy. This is not, you know, configuring your delegates in your link client settings or team dial or things like that, where individual users can collaborate and say, this is how we're going to manage calls coming into the group. This is something that your admin has to do. So typically, we don't see this deployed very much, but where it's needed, it's very important. And the admins manage it. The end users don't actually take care of this themselves. Okay, so that's the media services. Any questions? Yeah, before we move on. You want only one. I think the question is to rephrase: can you whitelist the people that can just call an individual user? The easiest way to do that is, well, I think there are ways to do that. It's not managed through the services that we described here. There are techniques that you can use to do that. I would want to, maybe we should talk offline after to, so I can be precise about exactly how you do that. But it can be done. Any other questions before we continue? Okay, let's talk about devices. And when I talk about devices here, I'm not going to talk about USB devices because they're pretty straightforward, right? You buy one off of the, hopefully, off of the qualified list on the Link catalog, and you know, you plug in your headset or your speakerphone and off you go and you've got no problems. Phones aren't that simple. So we're going to spend a little bit of time talking specifically about IP phones. And we have somewhere near 30 distinct phone SKUs from partners in our programs today, from the five partners that you see here: Audio Codes, SNOM, HP, Polycom, and SpectraLink. And as you can see, you know, there's a variety of form factors. We've got some IP conference phones, a wide variety of desk phones that have their own unique features and capabilities, and we also have from SpectraLink some handheld ruggedized wireless devices. For environments where maybe using a smartphone is just not practical or appropriate. Yes?
Can you explain?
We're going to talk about that here. Okay. So the question was, you've heard that Microsoft is no longer going to support the phone edition. I'll start by pointing out that that's not actually true. They are certainly supported. There are CUs that are issued for Link Phone Edition on a regular basis. There is a development team that is working on it. I just came from that team 4 months ago, so I know that they're there. There's not as aggressive a feature work that's happening on that platform today as you see from our compatible device partners. And let's focus on that here. So. You know, just because you asked the question, I want to make sure you understand. They are absolutely supported. They're going to continue to be supported. We're issuing CUs, fixing bugs, some feature enhancements to them. You're just not going to see as much change out of that platform and evolution as you're going to see from the compatible devices. So there's two classes of them. Link Phone Edition, which runs the Link-developed phone experience that we shipped first back in Link 2010. And that was developed, again, and is supported by Microsoft, the software, but it's running on partner hardware that they distribute. And it was designed primarily for a couple of very specific use cases: knowledge workers, the conference room experience, and a common area. And a common area phone. And for those scenarios, it delivers a pretty compelling experience, right? We have the ability to pair and tether with PCs so that actions and controls that happen between the phone and the desktop are reflected on the device. The phone remains the active audio endpoint in the conversation, even though you have the ability for PC control. There's integration with Exchange, which allows us to deliver some rich conferencing capabilities, including one-click join. You walk into your desk in the morning before you've even unlocked your PC, but your conference call is starting because you were stuck in traffic. You can just hit the button on your phone that says join your meeting, and in you go. The other category of devices are phones that the hardware and software belong exclusively to our partners. And they have built their products and they have built the software to be compatible directly with Link. With the assistance of the Link engineering and test teams, we put them through qualification tests and make sure that it meets certain minimum bars of capabilities and scalability and security. But in terms of who is deciding what are the feature sets, what are the markets that they're trying to deliver those to, what are the needs that they're trying to serve, we leave that to the partners to determine. All right, so because they do that, you get things like, you know, some of our partners producing devices that have language localization in markets where Link Phone Edition we just haven't supported previously. You see form factors like the wireless handsets that the Link Phone Edition experience was never really designed to work on, and frankly can't work on because they're wireless platforms, and that was inherently built to be sort of a wired desk experience. So our partners are, they have the flexibility, and they are, in the devices that you see on the catalog today, providing a range of capabilities that sort of extend far beyond what we're able to do with Link Phone Edition today. And for those applications where those use cases are important, we have this program, and again, we qualify those devices from our partners. And when we qualify them, what we do is we set a minimum bar of functionality, of experience, to make sure that, you know, anything that comes through this program, like we do with the USB program, meets certain minimum expectations of what these devices can do, right? And one example that I like to use all the time is a full ICE firewall traversal stack, right? Anybody that deploys Link, I hope, is familiar with and knows the power and value of being able to access Link and use it from anywhere, whether you're inside the network, whether you're in your home office, whether you're sitting in a Starbucks or a hotel somewhere. We apply the same requirements on IP phones in the compatible program, that they need to be able to penetrate the firewall and work regardless of where they are, obey the policies that are pushed down by the Link server, do so in a very secure, very scalable way. And we work directly with them to ensure that.
Question.
Yes?
Since the optimized phone seems to be sustained engineering mode, do you see third party manufacturers starting to pull those features into their catalog?
So the question is, are compatible partners, compatible device partners, are they pulling some of those Link Phone Edition features into their devices? The answer is yes. And if you go down to the floor here, if it's still open when we're done here, I think you'll see a couple of our partners demoing a lot of those capabilities even now. A couple of those scenarios they've been a little bit further out on the roadmap for a while, so you haven't seen them, you know, say since 2010 or 2011, but things like pairing with the PC, the ability to easily join a conference call from the phone without having to unlock the PC or dial in the extension directly. The partners are working on that. I think they've got devices here that can demonstrate that even today, even if they've not fully shipped and qualified those yet. It's definitely in progress. Yeah, I really wish we didn't have this notion, right? But at the end of the day, the thing that I want you to keep in mind, when you hear somebody say optimized devices, there's only one thing you should think. That is, it's running the Microsoft software, right? Because at the end of the day, very, very soon, you're going to see our partners with their compatible platforms being able to provide all the same very capabilities that you have in Link Phone Edition today, and doing some things that we have not done in Link Phone Edition, right? So I know that when we say optimized, it sounds like these are the phones we want you to buy, right? These are the good ones. You know, the name sort of implies that, but it's actually not the case, right? There's a lot of cases today where the software that you see on the compatible devices is actually more appropriate for customers. And as they continue to iterate and add some of these features that have been missing, I think it's going to be more and more obvious. So I keep talking about these features. Let's highlight a couple of them. Right? You know, the ability of our partners in this program to innovate and iterate in ways that Microsoft isn't doing. One is you have the ability to go to those vendors and tell them what your needs are, right? And it's not controlled by Microsoft, right? So, you know, if you're talking to multiple IP phone vendors and you have a specific need or specific scenario, you go and talk to them. One of them delivers it for you. That's terrific, and you get exactly what you need. Some of the things that you were never going to get out of Link Phone Edition, but you will see in compatible phones, is something as simple as programmable keys. Right? We have no such notion in the Link Phone Edition devices. They're all over the floor from our partners downstairs today and with the compatible devices. Expansion modules for receptionist or somebody that needs sort of the sidecar, if you will, where you can add multiple of these things onto the side. And they're even getting to the point where you can map them to contact groups from your link contact list, so these things just pre-populate based on the list that you've set up and managed on your desktop. Now you don't even have to do the tedious work of like, well, I have all these keys, but who's going to sit here and program all these things? And then somebody leaves, and then, oh, at some point I'll get around to changing this. It synchronizes with your contact list, which is terrific. Right, so for people in that role, it becomes a much easier way to manage and deploy that. Wireless, again, whether it's Wi-Fi or DECT, that's something that you're only going to get from a compatible device partner. 802.1x line authentication, Link Phone Edition is not capable of doing that, but our partners very well are. And there's even certain scenarios that ride on the link protocols to deliver experiences that we haven't necessarily either, you know, when we think about knowledge workers or our 80% use case for who's doing voice with link, we don't even necessarily think that Microsoft doesn't necessarily think they're important, but to you or your customer, they may be critical, right? So something like paging or intercom. There's no paging button in the link client anywhere, right? But we're based on common protocols, and what our partners have done is using extensions to SIP on top of the work that they've already done. You can set up relationships between an executive and an admin so that if, you know, I don't think it's a compelling scenario for me, but the admin can press a button and be talking into the manager's office, right? You can build paging solutions similarly with that. You can localize in different languages. You can have music on hold experiences that exceed what we're able to deliver in Phone Edition today, just based on the plans of our partners. And when you deploy these, right? So at the end of the day, we have to deploy these things, and you know, there's a couple of link server policies and settings that you need to apply to make sure that you have a smooth rollout. But the first most important thing is when you're rolling out IP phones, obviously now you probably need to be thinking about E911. When you're thinking about E911, well, now I need to think about port authentication. So if you don't have LLDP med for VLAN, you know, to identify the port so that when somebody calls emergency, you know where that came from. You need to start thinking about, now that I'm putting these devices out there, how do I set that up and how do I build that database of locations? Power over Ethernet we recommend in all of our customers. Phone provisioning settings like DHCP and NTP. Our phones generally inherit all the policies that the Link desktop clients do, so all the settings and user policies that you put into Link, obviously the devices adhere to those as well. But there is some need for things to be set up so that the devices can bootstrap in the first place. How do they get time? How do they get the URL of our certificate services so that I can sign in with a PIN without having to find a way to punch in a username and password? These are things that, whether it's Link Phone Edition or compatible, they are some additional settings. They're fully documented, right? There's some TechNet topics on deploying phones with Link. It's pretty straightforward, but if you don't remember to do these things, your devices aren't going to be able to connect up. And another thing, you know, one thing I like to emphasize is that if you're considering deployment of compatible phones, they may have some of their own deployment capabilities. You know, maybe your needs for deploying IP phones, you know, for common area devices, you need to have some specific provisioning rules in place or policies that are set on those devices that we don't necessarily have analogous settings for in Link, but you need to push them out to the devices nonetheless. You have a couple of options for how you could do that. One is the vendor for those devices may have their own provisioning story. Maybe it's based on TFTP. They have their own provisioning server that you can prop up. We also have extensions to Link in-band provisioning that if partners choose to do it, and you should inquire with them if they support it, that they can actually set extension policies inside of Link using PowerShell that the devices can then pull down from the Link server when they sign in and apply them, even for things that we don't have sort of a a notion for, there's not a designated policy for, they can define their own. And right on time, I went into yellow. Any questions? Yep, please. Yeah, so the question is, can you transfer to voicemail? I'm not going to say all of them from a physical phone. I'm not going to say all of them can do it, but most of them can. I see two of them right, sitting right here, the guys from Snowm here, they absolutely can do it. It's just a simple feature on the phone, right? I mean, if they don't have it and you need it, you know, it's not something that they can't choose to implement. There are devices that do it, that are with Link. Your specific device that you're looking at from Polycom, I'm not sure. Any other questions? Very straightforward, yeah. Any other questions? All right, thank you. Safe travel home. Thank you for coming this week.